This week on Making Contact.
The way I saw it was, oh my God, he's looking at prison time for speaking with me.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile three independent journalists, unbought and unbossed. Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena was kidnapped by Iraqi resistance fighters while on assignment in Iraq, then shot by U.S. soldiers on her release. Maria Suarez founded the Feminist International Radio Endeavor in Costa Rica, bringing the struggle for global justice to the airwaves. And U.S. journalist Sarah Olson broke the news of Army Lieutenant Aaron Watada's refusal to deploy to Iraq. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series. In addition to the horrific civilian and military death toll, nearly 200 journalists have died covering the first 5 years of the war in Iraq. Some reporters have been held in U.S. military prisons in Iraq and Guantanamo. Others have been kidnapped by Iraqi insurgents. Italian correspondent Giuliana Segrena was taken hostage while working on a story about the destruction of Fallujah. After a month of captivity, she was freed in March 2005, only to be shot and almost killed by U.S. soldiers. Nicola Calipari, an Italian diplomat who negotiated Giuliana's release, was killed protecting her as U.S. troops opened fire on their car.
I will not recover completely my shoulder because the bullet exploded inside, and so there are a lot of problems. And this is the physical point of view, and then there is the psychological point of view, of course, that is even more problematic, I think. When you are liberated, you can be happy of your liberation normally, but for me it was different because it was my liberation and the death of Nicola Calipari. I don't think that I am the cause, but Nicola Calipari, he was killed protecting me, and I remember the sensation that I got when I realized that the body that is covering me was dead. And when they bring up the body of Nicola, it was like they took a part of me away. It's something that I could never forget. So it's very hard to go on after this kind of experience. So for me, it's now a new life after my release. And I don't know if it's better than before or worse. It's difficult to say. Now it's more tiring than before because I have lost the enthusiasm of life. I want to live because, of course, I want to live, but I am not enthusiastic as before. And this is a very important part of my life that I lost.
News of Giuliana's kidnapping brought the Iraq War home to the Italian people. Even soccer star Francesco Totti and his entire team wore jerseys reading Free Giuliana during internationally televised games. Some credit Giuliana's kidnapping for the groundswell of public opinion that forced the withdrawal of Italian troops from Iraq. Segrena agrees with them.
After the very big demonstration against the war happened. So there was a kind of interiorization of the defeat. So for the peace movement, it was difficult to go back to the street and to remobilize, even if people in Italy was against the war and then against the occupation. But when I was kidnapped and they decided in my newspaper that it was a political kidnapping, so it was important to mobilize people. And they did. And I think that it was really very intelligent, the slogan that they used, that was Free Giuliana, Free Iraq. And the demonstration was a very big demonstration. It was 500,000 people in the street. And so it was very important to mobilize people to ask for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. I think that the mobilization for my liberation was important for the peace movement in Italy to regain the field and to remobilize. And also we succeeded in Italy with the withdrawal of troops from Iraq, but there are still important points that we have to face on the same subject. In Italy, we have a lot of U.S. bases and NATO bases, and there is one in particular that is the one of Vicenza in the north of Italy. That is a big one, but not only that. The fact is that the United States want to double this base. And from this base, leave the troops for Iraq, and not only the troops, also the flights. So this is a very big contradiction.
Julianis Grena began her career writing for a publication called War and Peace, later joining the Italian newspaper Il Manifesto, which sent her to areas of conflict. But she insists that she's not a war correspondent and was never drawn to war, as journalist Christopher Hedges describes getting hooked on covering wars.
I don't want that war become my job. I always hope to go back to Iraq, to Afghanistan, and to other countries when they will be in peace. But I think that we have to cover the war because we have to tell the people the effect of the war. And when I am in these countries, in this situation, I try to let know what is the feeling of the people, how is the daily life of people living under bombing every day, under occupation. My job is more to give voice to the ones that have no weapons. So in the majority of the cases, I give voice to the women because they are the people that more suffer the war. So I think that the only possibility, the only power we have as women is to make a strong relationship, and we can help them to raise their voices. We never realize in the Western countries that in Muslim countries or other countries, they think as we think. They have the same feeling as we have. They want democracy as we want democracy. They want the rights of women as we want the rights of women. So they have the same in Iraq, in Afghanistan, everywhere.
Julianis Grena has not returned to Iraq since her capture and release in 2005, but she didn't make that choice based on fear.
As journalist, it's impossible to go now in Iraq as independent journalist. So you can't go there and go around and get interview. And so you can do only the official things to be in contact with the official in the green zone. And so, but you can't do anything about social life or to get in touch with other people. So the only chance to go there is to be embedded with the troops or to stay closed in a hotel. If you are embedded, of course, you get information from the military commanders, and you can go there and stay in a hotel or to stay in a house well protected, and you send around Iraqi journalists. So, and now it's impossible to have an independent information in Iraq. This is a problem not only for journalists as me, but for public opinion. How they can have an opinion if they have no independent information?
In her book, Friendly Fires, Grena writes that prior to her capture, she had not realized just how bad it could get for reporters trying to cover the war. But in conflicts like the one in Iraq, where neither side wants any witnesses, even journalists are considered the enemy. Costa Rica-based journalist Maria Suarez created the Feminist International Radio Endeavor, or FIRE, as a way to use Costa Rica's public airwaves in the service of grassroots democracy, bringing the voices of women in particular to a wider audience. FIRE is a sister project of Making Contact, and both are fiscally sponsored by the International Media Project.
I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, right next to the military base of Buchanan. And I was a child of the harshest part of the Cold War when the missiles crisis happened in Cuba. And I remember being called off from school to come back home because the world was in crisis, and the crisis I had right next door because there was a military base. And I realized, although I was told oftentimes that the threat was communism and that the Russians were going to come down the road or the Chinese were going to come, the Red Army were going to come down the road and take out all of our rights, as a child, what was taking away all my rights to circulate, to go to school, to have any kind of sense of community in my barrio, was that I had a U.S. military base next that would put everybody in crisis and on command whenever there was a crisis anywhere in the world. And from right there, I understood that militarism, that abuse of power, that policies of using a country and occupying a country to wage war on everybody was the problem that we had in the world. Too often, mainstream media only concentrates the voices of the people that are in public office, that have the power, and we don't hear the ordinary day-to-day people who have alternatives that don't have to do with that kind of confrontation and that kind of abuse. And those are the voices that we have to hear. So I decided that I was going to get in radio because radio would allow me to have women's voices in the case of FIRE without any censorship. FIRE is about giving women a voice with their perspectives on all issues, not only women's issues. The more I do it for the last 15 years, the more I realize that in the voices of many women, it's a different paradigm, a different approach to life that is very much needed. Because otherwise, we think that the only way of living is the style that is imposed on us hegemonically by the market and by the media that says that development is about having a choice to consume everything, even if it can kill you, or that relationships are about who abuses who and who's smarter in abusing who, and not about being able to develop a common livelihood, and that the environment is for using and abusing and not for developing a relationship with it that allows for sustainability.
Maria settled in Costa Rica, politically the most stable country in Central America. There, she found the popular support that has allowed FIRE Radio to become the longest-running women's information service available on shortwave radio. Currently, Maria is focusing on the debate in Costa Rica about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Many in Costa Rica don't want their government to sign on to it, and Maria sees the treaty as a threat to Costa Rica's progressive policies.
Imagine a country that has oil reserves that it hasn't exploited, and that one of the reasons is that the indigenous people that live in those places believe that the oil that goes through the land is the blood of the Mother Earth that gives it the nutrients for them to be able to grow their crops. That is the situation of the Talamanca in Costa Rica. Imagine that it hasn't been exploited because that country has nice agreements with other countries that have exploited their oil, and therefore they can buy it for a cheaper price than it would be to exploit its own oil. Imagine that it's a country that does not exploit its soil because it has decided that protecting the biodiversity is more valuable than exploiting its soil. And imagine that in that country there's such a strong environmental movement that it has been able to stop companies that want to exploit that oil Costa Rica has been a country who abolished the army in 1948. Together with abolishing the army, it legislated for the protection of the commons. And the commons for us is not only the environment, although more than 50% of the environment in Costa Rica, the biodiversity, is protected. But commons, we also mean electricity, telecommunications or the airwaves, and water as a common good that then is administered by the state and provided as a service to the people. So all of this package is what is being threatened now by the CAFTA agreements. Because, for example, the CAFTA agreements has a clause that says that arms could be built in Costa Rica. Well, I know also as a Puerto Rican, you can be sure that they're going to come in. It also has the provision of privatization of telecommunications. And telecommunications in Costa Rica is still a public domain, is still the responsibility of the state. And telecommunications is a healthy service in Costa Rica that not only provides telecommunications for 98% of the population, but it makes enough money so that it gives money for the health and the education as a universal service. So we're talking about a service that is very sound also economically, and CAFTA will dismantle all of the legal system that we have for trying to have a fair negotiation within the unfairness of the globalization of the neoliberal policies. And we don't want to dismantle our legal system of sovereignty and protection and so on, because that is the game in which we are able to solve conflicts by peaceful resolutions and not by force. So we have taken to the streets to resist signing a treaty that will do away with everything that we have stood for the last 50 and more years.
Maria Suarez is active in a widespread and powerful grassroots movement in Costa Rica against CAFTA. It includes two of the country's former presidents, Catholic bishops, indigenous people, the teachers' union, students, campesinos, and small business owners. The coalition has managed to delay the Costa Rican government's attempts to bring CAFTA to a showdown vote.
I think freedom as a subjective thing, as a thought pattern, is what I haven't given up. And then by not giving it up, I am able to listen to nature screaming to us about what we're doing. I am able to listen to alternative voices. I am able to listen to experiences that are showing me what Arundhati Roy says so well in her book. I'm going to paraphrase it. There cannot be so much abuse of power without humanity finally taking a stance on it. And on a clear day, if I am quiet enough, I can hear her beating and coming, beating the heart and coming.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like more information, or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Independent U.S. journalist Sarah Olson began her career reporting for San Francisco's low-power FM station, Liberation Radio. She moved on to work with Making Contact, Pacifica Radio, and National Public Radio, in addition to writing for print and internet media. A special focus of Sarah's work is the current anti-war movement.
I have been covering the anti-war movement in the Bay Area for quite some time, since before the Iraq War started, really since before September 11th. I covered various members of the military who had been discharged as conscientious objectors. And so about a year ago, some folks approached me and said, we've got this guy. He's an officer in the Army. He's a lieutenant. He's thinking he might not want to go to Iraq. He's trying to resign and he's trying to, you know, get deployed someplace else, but none of that's working. So he's thinking he might have to just refuse to go. Do you want to talk to him? And of course, I said, yeah, sure. That would be great. And I knew at that time that it would be a very big story because U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watada was the highest ranking member of the military to refuse to deploy to Iraq. He was the first officer to refuse to deploy. And he was incredibly smart, very articulate. He said that he felt that the Iraq War was illegal and immoral. He felt like participating in it would make him party to war crimes. He cited a lot of international and domestic law, some of the military's own law. And he talked about feeling a real responsibility to the values, the principles of democracy that he had sworn to uphold. He talked about feeling a real sense of responsibility to the men and women that would report to him. And he didn't want to just avoid going to Iraq. He wanted to help bring about an end to the war. And to that end, he was very resolute in his desire to speak publicly about his opposition and hopefully start to generate a debate within this society about the Iraq War. I think he's a very earnest, sincere person. These are earnest questions of a patriot who loves his country, who loves serving in the military, who referred to the military uniform as something with it honorable, time-honored tradition. This is not someone who is bombastically speaking in the heat of the moment.
Sarah Olson aired the very first interview with Lieutenant Watada on Making Contact in May of 2006 and published articles about him in print and online. Lieutenant Watada held his first press conference in June, and on the 22nd of June, he was given orders to deploy to Iraq. He chose to remain on base in protest at Fort Lewis in Washington State. It was then that Sarah herself heard from the Army.
They said, well, we actually wanted to talk to you about the story you published. Did Watada really say these things? And upon further conversation, it became clear that they were looking at Lieutenant Watada's charges sheet. And on that charges sheet were statements that he'd made to me. So at that point, I think he was facing 6 years in prison, something like that. At one point, he was facing 8.5 years in prison. But really, the way I saw it was, oh my God, he's looking at prison time for speaking with me. And that was an eye-opening experience. And basically, I told the public affairs officer at Fort Lewis that they would need to send me what they wanted me to confirm. And that was really the last time I talked to anyone in the Army at Fort Lewis on the prosecution team. So that began the whole subpoena process. The subpoena that was presented to me on three different occasions said that if I refused to answer the questions, if I didn't appear, the consequences was a felony contempt of court charge and up to 6 months in prison.
Sarah was called not only to answer questions about her interviews with Lieutenant Watada, the Army also wanted her to testify as a witness for the prosecution at Watada's court-martial.
After I was subpoenaed, I published an op-ed in Editor and Publisher that basically outlined my position. And I feel like it's a journalist's job to report the news, right? It's not to participate in these kinds of political prosecutions. And when you do participate, the very existence of these kinds of subpoenas erodes a barrier between press and government. And I find that to be problematic on several levels. I think it clearly is going to silence dissenting voices. I think it will intimidate people who are considering coming forward and telling their stories. What's important to me is that people like Lieutenant Watada get to speak, that they have some sort of platform, some sort of way to present their case. And when you think about the media coverage of the Iraq War today, the men and women fighting in the Iraq War, they're not represented in the media to the extent that they should be. So I was very lucky. I had a number of really important advisors, and the media reform conference happened in Memphis. And so I was able to make my case to the rest of the journalists in the country, everyone from Amy Goodman to Helen Thomas. And after the media reform conference, I was able to build a pretty impressive coalition of professional organizations, academics, that called on the Army to drop the subpoena. And eventually what happened was that the Army dropped the two charges that resulted from Lieutenant Watata speaking to individual journalists, myself and the other journalists subpoenaed in the court-martial. And I consider that to be a very good victory in the sense that we did not set a precedent that members of the military can be prosecuted for speaking to journalists. I think that's very important. And it's one of several things that I set out to do. And I'm grateful that it came together in that way. Actually, the whole thing was very exciting. I think that what's important, and what I didn't realize maybe until I was in the midst of it all, is that independent journalists are actually very well positioned to do these types of things, to really kind of raise a ruckus on behalf of the First Amendment, on behalf of press freedom, and some of the really fundamental notions that those ideas represent. And we're well positioned to do that because we don't work for anyone. No one was able to tell me, you need to be quiet, you know, let your lawyer handle it. So I was able to outline and articulate my objections to this. I just felt very lucky that I wasn't forced into a situation where I had to remain silent, or forced into a situation where, you know, I was being asked to compromise what I saw as being my professional integrity and my personal integrity. And the role of the press, as I see it, is to ask tough questions, to hold those in power accountable, to make sure that the government and the corporations in the United States are representing the public interest, and frankly, to facilitate debate around these important questions of the day, like the Iraq War, for example. And certainly, I think after the Iraq War began, when you saw media outlets like the New York Times issuing public apologies, saying, we're really sorry, we didn't discuss this enough, we didn't debate this enough, I think it's clear that we don't have today, we didn't have then, the necessary debate regarding the Iraq War. So that's my job as a journalist. That's what I think is important.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional music by Dar Williams, Kay Neiman, and Mel Pice. Special thanks to Lisa Rudman, Executive Director of the National Radio Project, and to National Public Radio West in Los Angeles. Stephanie Welch is production engineer. Peggy Law is our founding director. Senior producer, Tina Rubio. Communications manager, Dorian Taylor. Intern, Alexis McCrimmon. Volunteers, Ron Rucker and Dan Turner. And I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.